Thanks, Ben. I'm very happy to be here talking about this work, which was from December with David Meltzer, who is a grad student at Yale, who will be starting as a postdoc at Caltech in the fall. And so the starting point for this talk is simple. So I want to study the OPE of two stress tensors in CFT. So schematically, this takes the following form. So we want to constrain these couplings of two stress tensors to some other operators O. Why is this an interesting thing to study? Hopefully, it's clear. But just to mention three reasons that motivate me. Every local CFT has one. This is not a particularly specialized object. I'd say that in general, we don't understand this particularly well, despite its centrality in CFT. And perhaps part of the reason is that in dimension 2, this is trivial, because the Virasoro algebra exists in any 2D CFT, and it's a subalgebra of the theory. So it closes on itself. The only operators that appear here are things made of T. And there's nothing more to say once you know the algebra. This is not true in higher dimensions. And in ADS CFT, the stress tensor is dual to the graviton. So there's a lot of gravitational physics from the holographic perspective hiding in these coefficients. So one way to phrase the question that I'll be asking is, in ADS, what can decay into two gravitons? And we will discuss CFTs with weakly coupled local holographic duals that we usually talk about. We'll also come up with some constraints that apply to all CFTs. So in the first case, there's a simple answer. So in gravitational language, if we have classical, i.e. tree level GR, coupled to low spin matter, which means spin less than or equal to 2, in this case, the answer is only the graviton. So this is two stress tensors, two gravitons, and some other operator, which is not T. The claim is that to leading order in a scale which I will later focus on, this is 0. On the other hand, in a general theory of quantum gravity, we will bound these decay rates. So in a picture, you have, we'll come up with bounds that are of the following form, that the square of this amplitude is bounded above schematically by the decay amplitude of the graviton itself. In CFT language, these will be some rules on, not some rules rather, but inequalities on these OPE coefficients, where O is not the stress tensor, in terms of the OPE coefficient where O is the stress tensor. OK, so let me give you a more detailed outline of how we'll proceed. So first, some more motivation from the ADS CFT perspective in particular. So I'll talk about bulk emergence the famous bound on A minus C, and the idea of consistent truncation, all of which will lead us to think about these TTO couplings. There's a nice history here, which I'll briefly review. The tool we will use will be Red J physics of systems of spinning CFT correlators. Which I will introduce. And with this, we will then attack CFTs that have large N and a large gap to the higher spin operators. In this talk, that's what gap will mean, gap to the dimension of the lightest higher spin single trace operators. Then we will relax this assumption, talk about bounds on these OPE coefficients, generic CFTs, perhaps with some application. To the structure of the stress tensor three-point function in a general interacting CFT. OK. Maxwell. Good. OK, so part one. First, let me review this quest to understand what are the sufficient conditions for a CFT to have a weakly coupled local nice holographic dual, where I will define nice shortly. So there was a paper from 2009 by Heemskerk, Panadonis, Sully, and the late great Joe Polchinski that really kicked off this topic in earnest. And this deserves some brief review. So they made a startling conjecture, which has stood the test of time to this point. And it was based on the following type of calculation. So solutions to large N crossing are in one-to-one correspondence with ADS contact interactions. So what do I mean by solutions to large N crossing? Well, first it's important to introduce the notion of a double trace operator in a large N theory. So if I have some single trace operator O, then we can form composites. So at the double trace level, we have operators which are usually denoted like this, which can be schematically defined as an O, N powers of del squared, L open indices, all acting on O, minus some traces such that this is a conformal primary operator. So there's one for every N and L. Here I'm taking O to be a scalar for simplicity. And so what they did is they looked at the connected four-point function of some scalar O. So we're looking at the leading order connected four-point function. So in my convention throughout this talk, I'm going to take the central charge to scale like N squared. So if we look at the order one over N squared piece of a four-point function in which we only allow sums over these double trace operators. So we sum over N, we sum over the spin L. We bound it above by some capital L, which is finite. So we're making this kind of ansatz for the four-point function. If you solve crossing, then there is a map between those solutions and quartic vertices in ADS with 2L plus 2 derivatives scattered amongst the legs. Okay. Actually, there's less than or equal here. Okay. So for instance, let's just put it here. If we just take phi to the fourth theory in ADS, we have a quartic vertex like this. This contributes to a four-point amplitude of the dual operator. And the double trace operators that you get in the conformal block decomposition have spin zero only. So if you solve crossing, when capital L is zero, you find one solution, and it's the solution you get for this diagram, which is one of these so-called D functions. Okay. Likewise, at higher spins, there are this many solutions. Okay. So you can add single trace operators to this story, and you can go to higher orders in 1 over n. This is some work that I've done in the past year with Fernando Aldai, Agnese Bisi, and Ofer Aharoni. For the purposes of this talk, we want to focus on the conjecture that this led them to, which is the following. So if you have a CFT with large n and a large gap to higher spin single trace operators, which I will call delta gap, that this implies that there is a weakly coupled local ADS dual. Here I mean local and ADS scales. And so the conjecture is especially interesting this way. This way is something we basically already knew. But the point is that any CFT with these properties has a dual which is weakly coupled and local. Okay. So this is a striking statement because the only condition besides large N is a single spectral condition on the higher spin operators. But the claim is that all the other OPE data, three-point functions in particular, are organized such that once you impose this, they match the structure of a nice theory of gravity in ADS. So it's very far from obvious that this is actually true, but it does seem to be true. Okay. So this was in 2009. Since then, there's been some papers that sort of fleshed this out and gave some more credence to it. In 2017, Simon Caron Huo showed that these quartic vertices are suppressed by powers of the higher spin gap, as you might expect from integrating out a heavy particle. So modulo some exceptions, he showed that these types of quartic vertices are actually suppressed, not just that their solutions map to solutions of crossing. This is important for an effective field theory interpretation in the bulk. Still, we don't have any understanding of the cubic vertices in the theory. And one thing that we see in all the nice examples, say supergravity compactifications, is that the gravity sector, rather, is that of Einstein gravity, AKA general relativity. And in this so-called Chems paper from 2014, they showed that a large gap implies Einstein gravity. So in particular, in CFT terms, if you look at the three-point function of stress tensors, there are three different conformal structures, which we can parametrize like this. So there's the structure that gets turned on by looking at cubic vertices in GR. Then there is another structure, which gets turned on once you add R squared terms. And there's a third structure, which gets turned on once you add R cubed terms. And they showed that these coefficients are suppressed by powers of delta gap, or the powers are fixed just by dimensional analysis. This is a non-trivial statement indeed. Now, in the bulk, so there's the Einstein term plus the cosmological constant. And you have some R squared term, say. And the claim is that this coefficient is suppressed by the mass scale of higher spin particles. In ADS5, CFT4, so for me, little d will be the boundary dimension throughout this talk. This parameter alpha goes like the difference of central charges, A minus C, divided by C. Okay. So this bound gets translated into a by now famous bound on the difference of A and C central charges, namely their magnitude, divided by C, is bounded above by 2 powers of the inverse gap scale. Okay. But To me, at least, this is somewhat unsatisfactory for two reasons. The first is a little sharper. The second is more philosophical. In superconformal field theories in four dimensions, A and C don't depend on the gap scale. So in this discussion, you want to regard the gap scale as a proxy for the coupling. Like in n equals 4, this is some lambda to the 1/4. Generally speaking, large gap is like strong coupling. And you should think of gap, or at least I am here, as a modulus, an exactly marginal coupling. And in superconformal field theories, A and C don't depend on such couplings. So this bound relates two quantities to something which they don't depend on. This is to say that we don't have a single example where this is even parametrically saturated. Instead, in these examples, this difference is bounded above by some power of n, where this power is either 1 or 2, roughly speaking. It's 1 if the bulk dual is an open string dual, and 2 if it's closed. Without supersymmetry, A still doesn't depend on exactly marginal couplings because of the A theorem. C, we don't know if it does, but we also don't know if there are fixed lines without supersymmetry, so we're kind of stuck. The second point is that it would be interesting to understand the couplings between the graviton and the other stuff. If we're interested, for example, in whether a string theory is the unique UV-complete theory with other desirable properties, contains a graviton, et cetera, then we want to understand exactly what we can or must couple the graviton to. And that's what this kind of question would get at.
So what do you mean by L in general, like square root of C?
Oh.
How do you define M in general?
I'm taking this convention. Yeah, just think of this as a convention, and yeah. Yeah, that's it. OK. Good. So for these reasons, we want to look at something more. I guess I want to do that. So having already explained that this talk is about TTO couplings, it's clear where this is going. OK. Of course, you should interrupt with questions whenever you want. Yeah, please.
Is there a way to drop the absolute values in the inequality, or you cannot make a strong statement?
You mean in this Kempf's bound?
Oh, well, I don't know. Kempf's or something. So is there some statements that can be made, like A is always larger than C, or the other way around?
No. So certainly not in general. So there are CFTs that have finite n and infinite n, where you see both. But
okay, so
we know many more CFTs where C is greater than A. I don't think this is understood exactly why. OK. So now let's look at the Lagrangian of a bulk theory that is prototype where we usually think about in holography. So we have the gravity term, and we have some kinetic terms for some matter. These don't have to be scalars. I'm just being schematic here. Some cubic couplings. We have some quartic couplings, which I'll just right in terms of some function, which sprinkles derivatives throughout. And of course, there's higher order stuff, which doesn't matter for four-point functions, say. So this has two striking properties, one of which we've talked about so far, one of which we haven't. The first is that the gravitational sector I've written to be the Einstein action. Okay. But in this action, there's another interesting property, which is that not only is the gravity sector universal, but it's isolated. That is to say, there exists a consistent truncation to GR. So in other words, at the level of the classical equations of motion, I can set all the matter fields to zero. And this is a consequence of the fact that there are no couplings of this sort. Okay. In CFT language, this is the statement that these TTO couplings vanish in the dual to an action like this, to leading order in 1 over n. So every statement I'm going to make throughout this talk is about classical actions, tree-level statements. Okay. The important thing here is that this is a light operator not equal to the stress tensor. This is not a statement about a heavy operator decoupling. It's a statement about a light operator that actually survives low energy limit, but has a vanishing coupling with two stress tensors. So in the context of this motivation from this A minus C bound, it's worth noting that, well, obviously it addresses point two, that it couples gravity to matter, or rather doesn't, but we want to understand why it doesn't. And regarding the first point, this is more robust than A minus C, in the sense that even in 4D supersymmetric theories with submaximal supersymmetry, even if these operators are all protected, this can be a function of marginal couplings. And of course, in the absence of supersymmetry, you know, it could be if there were marginal couplings. So there are SCFTs, which we know and can control, where this is a function of the gap. Okay. And now we want to understand its behavior at large gap. So perhaps it's not a surprise that we might wonder whether this coupling is likewise suppressed by some powers of the gap scale. If it were, then a consistent truncation would be due, at least on the level of the cubic couplings, to the absence of light higher spin particles. So in other words, I take the higher spin mass to infinity. Right. So there's actually a more general property which I'll hopefully convince you of, which we want to argue for, which is the following. So ADS derivatives are plausibly dual to powers of the inverse gap scale, which is to say, if you have a classical action ADS with parameter G Newton and some other scale, which parametrizes this gap, are all powers in the derivative expansion suppressed by this same scale set by the mass of these higher spin particles? And I'm going to argue the answer is yes, and that's, you know, you've been to any talk before, you know that I'm going to try to establish these two things. Okay. So I want you to think of this as a kind of avatar of stringy behavior. So in string theory, we have the Planck scale and the string scale. I mean, the simple compactification, those are the two scales we need to care about. And if you look at the D plus one dimensional action in ADS, it descends from, say, 10 dimensions. And the low energy limit in 10 dimensions is a statement about L string getting small. And this descends to the fact that in the lower dimensional theory, all the derivatives are suppressed by the same scale, in other words, indirectly by the string scale. What I want to show is that just from looking at CFTs of the large gap to higher spin operators, you see this exact type of behavior. Okay. So that concludes this part. Okay. So how are we going to do it? We're going to look at systems of four-point functions of spinning operators in the Regre limit. We're going to use a unitarity bound on four-point functions in this limit to constrain these couplings. In particular, we're going to look at mixed systems, which is to say systems of three four-point functions, which will form some kind of matrix, which has to be positive semi-definite. And the off-diagonal components of this matrix will encode these off-diagonal OPE coefficients, and they will be bounded above. And at large gap, you can show this kind of suppression. If you don't impose large gap, then you can just derive general bounds. OK. So in a generic CFT, operators are organized into trajectories, aka families, which may be regarded as continuous functions of spin. So this was put on firm footing by Simone Caron-Huo's paper last year. For the sake of this talk, we'll need to just think about the concept of the leading Regre trajectory, which is the set of operators with lowest dimension at a given spin. Analytically continued to continuous spin. So if we define conformal dimension in this way, so this is just some convention, then we can draw a picture of what this leading trajectory looks like. So if we plot this parameter I nu on the x-axis and the spin parameter j of nu on the y-axis, then here is what some typical leading trajectory looks like. So what operators are living on this leading trajectory depends exactly on the theory. And this is potentially a subtle notion. For the sake of this talk, we're going to be thinking about large n theories mostly. And you can order the OPE in powers of 1 over n. And so in the context of looking at four-point functions, operator contributions can be split into single trace, double trace, and so on. And so we can think of the leading trajectory, for the sake of this talk, as comprised of the single trace operators at each spin, which are the lightest. So there's a few privileged points on this plot. Okay. So at I nu equals d over 2, the dimension is d. And you have the stress tensor, which of course saturates the spin 2 unitarity bound and is the lightest spin 2 operator you can have in a theory. So the stress tensor sits here. Okay. There's going to be some single trace spin 4 operator, which is defined by the condition that I nu equals delta gap minus d over 2. So this defines delta gap itself. So here we have some operator O4. Another interesting point, because you want to regard this as a continuous function of spin, is this intercept. Which is nu equals 0. And these ideas about Regre physics, of course, have grounding pre-CFT. And for the adaptation of this to CFT, a nice reference is this paper called Conformal Regre Theory by Costa, Gonsalves, and Panedonis. And I think Joao gave some talks about this at some point here, so you can find them online. Actually, for that matter, I think he probably talked about that paper as well. Okay. So what is conformal Regre theory? It adds up the contribution of Regre trajectories to correlation functions. So there's an infinite set of operators here. It performs the resummation of all of their contributions to, say, a four-point function in the Regre limit of kinematics. So we have some operator 01, 02, 03, 04. And if we take the Reggie limit. This is to be thought of as dominated by the exchange of this operator, the Regéon, which is parameterized by the spin J of nu. So it's really just this whole thing resummed, captured in the form of some kind of fictitious effective operator. So what is the Regé limit? Well, if you have some Euclidean correlation function, you can perform analytic continuation to get there. It's a Lorentzian regime of high energy scattering. And so if we have cross ratio Z and Z bar, so if we take, well, for the sake of clarity, let me just put this operator at 0. Take the Regé limit of this thing, then we take z bar around 1. And then you take z and z bar both to the origin with the ratio fixed. Okay. So if you have some Euclidean correlator, you can perform this procedure and you get the Regé limit of that correlator. So, if you imagine starting with the Euclidean correlator and writing it as a sum over conformal blocks, you can take the limit block by block, but each block diverges in this limit faster and faster as the spin becomes higher and higher. So the resummation here is important to get some bounded growth. And that's what conformal Regé theory does for you. It does this resummation. So if we look at a four-point function of two operators psi and two operators o, which will be the convention for going forward, so they're proportional to some amplitude A by some power law factor, which I'm not going to write, which is a function of cross ratios. Okay. And this thing here, the sum over operators, there's some OPE coefficients, which I'm going to call D, just to make things complicated. Okay. Usually you think of them as C, but there's a lot of bases flying around, so I just want to make things clear. And then we're going to have conformal blocks here. Okay. Now, if you look at the Regé limit, this guy here is often convenient to define a new set of variables. Z equals sigma e to the minus rho plus rho. Z bar equals sigma e to the minus rho. So the Regé limit is small sigma fixed rho. So in this limit, this goes like sigma to the 1 minus the spin. So higher spin means higher divergence. And so if there's to be a bound on the Regé growth, it's clear that you need some delicate interplay between all the contributions of spins above that bound. Okay. Indeed, there is a bound on this growth. So one way to phrase this is that there's a bound on chaos. The kinematic regime relevant for that is the same as the Regé regime. And what this says in terms of this Regé data is that the value of this Regé intercept is less than or equal to 2. So when you perform this analytic continuation of this full function, it's going to be some function of, well, as we'll see in a moment, it's an integral over this curve. And the intercept value must be less than or equal to 2. Okay. Good. Okay. Now, I left these spaces here because here I assumed, just for simplicity, that psi and o are scalars, in which case this is a correct expression. Now, if psi has spin, then there are multiple independent tensor structures for each exchanged operator. Sorry, this is terrible notation. this should be that. Okay. So there are now multiple tensor structures when the operators carry spin. And accordingly, we have to modify this formula. So we have some sum now over the number of independent tensor structures for the exchanged operator. So let us append an index k to this three-point function where we take psi to have spin, but we keep phi to be a scalar. And now the conformal blocks are acted upon by some differential operator. Good. Now, after you take the Regi limit of the answer, roughly speaking, looks like the following. You have some spectral integral over nu. Times some sum over structures, times some function alpha of nu, which here is proportional to the OPE coefficients squared, right? Times these differential operators in the Regi limit, which I'll just continue to call dk, times sigma to the 1 minus j of nu, and times some other function. This form right now is not important, which comes from taking the Regi limit of the conformal blocks. Okay. So you see that the growth here at small sigma is determined by this parameter j of nu. And there's an integral over nu. More useful for us will be some Fourier transform of this. And let me call this a hat. This Fourier transform is usually written as a function of some energy s and some fixed distance parameter L. In this case, the limit is large S, L fixed, as suggested by the notation. And you have some Fourier version of this type of integral. In the large S limit, you can perform a saddle point analysis. So this picks out some rho naught. Okay. And in this case, a hat grows like sigma. S to the j rho naught minus 1. Right. Now, by changing the value of L, so rho naught is a function of L, which you hold fixed. By changing the value of L, you can slide along different points on this trajectory. What's important for the sake of this talk is that you can reach the stress tensor point by picking a suitable value of L. Okay. Good. So that was a bit of a quick review of how this stuff works. Now let's finally get to the crucial condition and the new results. Okay. So there's a unitarity condition on this four-point function, which can be stated in the following way. What are these things? So this operator D of nu is defined to be an OPE coefficient now in this new sort of Fourier space basis. So I'm calling it B, not little d. Okay. It's an OPE coefficient of two phis with the Regi on evaluated on the saddle point times the sum over structures of the other OPE coefficient for these operators psi with the Regi on. This index k times this differential operator, okay, and pi is the propagator over a geodesic distance L on HD minus 1. Where does this come from? Well, maybe the most intuitive way to see it is that if you think of this as an ADS scattering process, you have particles that are scattering in the Regi limit, and the impact parameter for the scattering is this parameter L. And the impact parameter space, in other words, the transverse space between the trajectories, is HD minus 1. Okay. So this is a key formula for us. It encodes the OPE coefficients of the external operators with the Regi on. And we're going to use it to place some bounds. Okay. So what's the main idea? So as I said before, the idea here is to take this operator psi to be a linear combination of conformal primaries. When you do that, this thing D becomes a matrix, and we impose positive semi-definiteness of this matrix. Because D is a function of these three-point functions, you're going to get some bound in the off-diagonal components, and that's what we're going to use. Okay. So in particular, let's take psi to be some constant times some operator O1 plus some other constant times O2. Now this here is a matrix. Same thing here. And the unitarity condition in the Regular limit means that this object here should be positive semi-definite. So we have a matrix D1, 1, D1, 2, D2, 1, D2, 2, where I denote which piece of this this is in the Regular limit. Notation should be clear. And so we act on this guy pi, which is some function of L, insist on positive semi-definiteness, which is guaranteed by insisting that all the principal minors of this matrix are non-negative. So in particular, D11 needs to be positive, D22 needs to be positive, but more interestingly for us, the off-diagonal pieces are bounded above by the product of the diagonal just by taking the determinant. Obviously. Okay. Good. So these are bounds on these OP coefficients appearing in the definition of D. And now we want to specify even further. Take operator 1 to be the stress tensor. So these are bounds on these OP coefficients B, T, O. So we're going to take psi to be T plus O, where O is some scalar. Okay. These are bounds on T, O, J of nu naught. And now we're going to go to the point on the Regular trajectory, which corresponds to the stress tensor. Then J of nu naught goes to T. And these are bounds on the OP coefficient of T, T, O. So they're upper bounds in terms of TTT OP coefficient times TOO OP coefficient. Okay. And this is going to be the key thing. Okay. So what are the results? First, let's talk about large gap CFTs. Recall that the gap is defined by the point on the trajectory where this lightest spin 4 operator sits. Okay. So we're going to take delta gap to be large. And the strategy is to employ finiteness in this delta gap limit with the 1 over delta gap expansion of OPE coefficients. Okay. So if we have some three-point function, O1, O2, J of nu, then at large delta gap, we can write it like this. There's some leading term, which is finite in the limit, plus some sum over n. Of some polynomials of degree n in nu squared divided by delta gap squared. Now you see that for this operator, nu scales like delta gap. So this is going to be finite with this class of polynomials appearing in this expansion. Okay, so we don't need to actually know what these polynomials are. All that this tells us is a strategy for computing the suppression of certain OP coefficients with the gap. If this vanishes, then away from the intercept, you have delta gap suppression. And in particular, if you sit at the stress tensor point in the trajectory, where the red ion becomes T, then you have some suppression of this three-point function of O1, O2T by 2 powers of the gap. So we want to show that at the intercept, the OP coefficients appearing in this matrix are indeed suppressed. Okay. So why would these off-diagonal components, D1, 2, vanish at the intercept? And the answer is that this propagator, pi of L, has the following property. At small values of the impact parameter, it has a power law behavior. Now, when you sit on this saddle point, you're taking L fixed and S large. And for a large gap theory, you optimize the bounds by taking L to be very small. So if the off-diagonal components have extra derivatives compared to the diagonals, then you're going to get powers of L. And the off-diagonal will blow up. And unless the OP coefficient is suppressed, you cannot satisfy positivity. That's the strategy. So let's work out an example, which is the main example for what I was talking about before. So we take this linear combination. We have a stress tensor contracted with some polarization vectors and some scalar O. Okay. So the TTO coupling has one structure, makes it particularly simple. This matrix D looks like this. If we look at the structure of the OP coefficients appearing, it's proportional to TT J of naught times BTO J of naught times 1 over L squared, and then BOO J of naught. And this extra 1 over L squared comes because of the fact that this one structure has extra derivatives compared to the diagonal structures. So one concludes that indeed, BTO intercept equals 0. And then now sliding up to the stress tensor point on the trajectory, which is within the saddle point approximation, one concludes that BTTO is suppressed, which was the goal.
Okay. Sorry, isn't that why we have J evaluated in 0?
So I'm taking this matrix, and I am looking at small values of L and near the intercept. So in the saddle point approximation, I have this new knot, which I can tune.
Yes.
But I want to take it to be 0, which is where I get the most strong bounds because of this power law behavior of this, this function. So really, this is acting on pi, right? So we have d pi, and that's what behaves this way.
So you get to choose a new knot?
You get to choose a new knot because it's a function of the impact parameter L. And as long as you stay within the validity of the saddle point approximation, you can do whatever you want. When you impose a large gap, you have a lot of latitude in what the impact parameter is allowed to be. And you optimize it by taking it small. But you're also allowed to take it to be large enough such that you can move from here to here. And this is the key point for us. You want to be able to replace the region by the stress tensor so we can constrain the physical coupling of the stress tensor to the other two operators. Yeah. I should say that this paper used a lot of technology. I should have said this earlier. In a paper by Costa, Hansen, and Panadonis from the summer, who used this type of stuff to establish the Chem's result that I mentioned before, among other things. And generalizing that to the case of mixed correlators is the main technical thing that allowed us to get these results. Okay. Okay, so now let's interpret this in the ADS picture, although perhaps this is clear. There are also some nice works about similar stuff by Kuleksizi, Parnachev, and Druboyadov, and Meltzer, Lee, in Poland, as well as a group at Cornell. Okay, good. So in ADS, this constrains a coupling of the following type. So if you just write down what is the first coupling of a scalar to two gravitons that survives field redefinitions, it can be written this way. Here is the ADS coupling. It's related to the CFT coupling by some kinematic factors. Relating these two requires a little care, but it can be done. And so you find that the claim is that this is suppressed by two powers of the scale of massive higher spin particles. And so. Good. This is the claim.
C is the vine?
Yes, yes. But I just chose that because this way ADS is still a solution. But you can cast this in a different form with field redefinitions if you want to. Good, okay. So let me make some comments and then end with a little table and some comments about the generic CFT case. So, good. The first comment is, if you turn on a Gauss-Bonnet term in the purely gravitational sector, then generically, you should also turn on this coupling. They're controlled by the same scale. This is putting some more meat on this idea that effective field theory should have these derivatives controlled by the same scale. Perhaps this is a useful type of constraint to keep in mind when doing some bottom-up type model building. The second comment is that we should be able to compute the first correction to these TTO type couplings using string theory. So part of the advertisement for why this should matter is that compared to A minus C, this is an effect that can actually be non-trivial in superconformal cases. So now you want to look at KK compactifications on ADS times M geometries, which contain some neutral scalars, so they can couple to two T's. And you want to keep the leading alpha prime correction in higher dimensions, perform the reduction, and derive the cubic couplings in the lower dimensional action, and read off TTO from that. This seems like an interesting challenge. This should be doable. There are two candidate CFTs, which luckily are not that baroque, which contain such a scalar and which might be worth studying. So the first is the Conifold case, so the ADS5 times T11 theory in the bulk. This has neutral scalars in the KK spectrum of dimension 2 and 6. The dimension 2-1 actually is protected, but like I said, this can still be a non-zero coupling, so maybe that's a good place to start. Also, if you look at the EBJM compactification in the type 2A regime, where you have a large lambda limit, then here there are scalars, which are neutral, of dimension 4, 5, and 6 in the KK spectrum. Those would be nice computations to consider doing. A third point is that imagine computing the change in CT under marginal deformation in a theory with a large gap. This is controlled by the TTO coupling, where O is the marginal operator. And the claim is that right, so this is controlled by this TTO coupling. Call this B. And so this is suppressed by delta gap. Not much is known in general about whether CT can change along lines of fixed points, but if you have a large gap, large N theory, there's some constraint on how much it can change at first order.
So in U2, in this conical series, I saw that lambda Gauss-Bonnet is zero.
Oh, yes, it, yes.
So then, you know,
funny things.
That would be the bad place to look for these extra couplings.
So it could be a case where one of them is zero and one's not. I would just say this is non-generic because of the supersymmetry. Yeah, so I mean, points one and two are in a different spirit. But yeah, I mean, in all these cases where A minus C is suppressed by powers of N, that's, again, because the supersymmetry kills the R squared term. But there should be cases where that term is killed, but this term is not. I don't see any reason to that.
I just wanted whether...
Yeah, no, you're right. Thanks for... It's an important thing to keep in mind. I mean, genericity is not always satisfied, especially when you're adding supersymmetry in the string side. And finally, there are other similar suppressions of other TTO type correlators. Let me make a little table. I just talked about the case where O is scalar for simplicity, but to establish this kind of conjecture that the derivative expansion is controlled always by this higher spin gap, you want to look at the coupling of, say, two T's to any light field of spin less than or equal to 2. So here we looked at TTO, which is like this phi vial squared guy. In three dimensions, there's a parity odd coupling, which is dual to coupling roughly of this form. In four dimensions, there's a parity odd coupling of two t's to a vector. It doesn't have to be conserved. In the bulk, this corresponds to a 5d Trin-Simons term. When v is a current, this is a term that reproduces the mixed anomaly, but it doesn't have to be a current. And finally, perhaps most interestingly, if you look at couplings of two t's to a massive spin 2, which I'll call m, you can show that these, like all of these in this column, are likewise suppressed by the expected powers of delta gap. So this is dual in the bulk to some, you know, there's some coupling of, it's a little harder to write covariantly, but if you look at Entrelle vertices, you can see that there's a four derivative term that appears to lowest order. Okay. So there's some intuition here. Again, effective field theory is very helpful. You look at the number of derivatives in the bulk, and then you want to try to show that the suppression is by this gap scale. And indeed, that's what we've shown. Okay. So got a few minutes left. I didn't talk much about the case of generic CFTs that don't have a large gap or even large n, which is a shame because there are some nice results there. Let me just mention one of those results, and then I will conclude. So if we use the same strategy, but we don't impose a large gap, then we have this positivity condition on this matrix. Now all of the entries are parametrically of the same order, and the positivity of the determinant gives you some upper bounds on these off-diagonal couplings, TTO. Okay. So for the case of scalar O, you get to the following sum rule. First, let's just talk about what happens for a single operator. So we take our state psi to be basically t plus o, and you get the following statement. The sum, well, okay, before we take a sum, the squared OP coefficient of two t's with an o times some function of delta is less than or equal to nb. So what is nb? Nb is the bosonic structure in the stress tensor three-point function written in this free field basis. So in other words, if you have a theory of free bosons, just this structure is turned on. Likewise for these fermionic and vector pieces. But in general, you can just think of these as some basis, some bookkeeping device. That's what nb is. And this function here is some function of delta, which I will not write for the sake of time. But basically, it's a product of gamma functions divided by some other product of gamma functions. You can also sum over scalar operators here, in which case you just get an enhanced bound like this. This same result was proven by Cordova, Maldacena, and Turiachi before our paper came out. using the average null energy condition. And you can reproduce it using regiophysics because, as has been established before, because of the dependence on the impact parameter in this calculation, you can actually tune the impact parameter to be large enough that the regeon essentially turns into the energy operator participating in the anech. So as a general statement, this regio calculation contains the anech calculation, and our result agrees with what they derive. Okay. There's a nice form to this function. There's some nice properties about it. But the key that I should emphasize as we wind down here is that there is some upper bound in terms of the stress tensor three-point function on the sum of these couplings.
F is a positive function, or is it?
Yes, thank you. So let me say a few things about F. F is a positive function. That is important. It also has some zeros. It has zeros at values of delta corresponding to the scalar double trace operators you make from two stress tensors. One way to see that this had to be the case is by counting powers of CT. So actually, here there's some norm of the state O. If you take O to be let's call it TT sub n, which is just T mu nu, T to the 2n, T mu nu. So this is a scalar. So these have dimensions 2d plus 2n. And these are the operators that participate in the mean field theory decomposition of the stress tensor four-point function, aka in an infinite CT theory, you have these two stress tensor composites. And generally, there's some anomalous dimension. But in mean field theory, it's just exactly this. At these values of delta, this function vanishes, as it had to, because if we count powers of CT, this scales like CT squared. And this can scale at most like CT. And so there'd be some inconsistency if you didn't have some zeros. That's one way to think about it. In fact, one nice thing you can do with this bound is to derive bounds on the MFT, mean field theory, OP coefficients of two stress tensors with the scalar double trace operators. And the bound is, if I square this and divide this by norm of these double trace guys, this is bounded above by this function of n, which is pretty nice. The way you get this is by looking at this function, which we know, expanding it around these zeros, and using known facts about the anomalous dimensions of these double twist operators in holographic theories, where the growth with little n is largest, to get a bound on the OPE coefficient. The reason this is interesting is that these OPE coefficients have never been explicitly computed. So here we have some bound or some parametric prediction for how they should behave. There are also bounds like this for TT spin 2. So we looked at the case, well, really all of these cases. These three were covered in this paper I mentioned before. This bound we derived is new, and it can be used to show that, or to argue anew, that in interacting CFTs, all three of these parameters must actually be non-zero. There's some precedent for this. This was conjectured by Zhuboyadov a few years ago. But here, by combining the sum rule with, rather the bound, with the analyticity and spin of operators in conformal field theory, you can make this argument. And the basic argument is, can be seen from here. One obvious feature of this bound is if you have a single non-zero entry on the left, NB has to be non-zero. If you have the spin 2 bounds, we have a bound 1 for each of NB, NF, and NV. And you can argue that there have to be spin 2 operators appearing in the TT OPE that appear in this bound with non-zero coefficient. And therefore, absent some highly non-generic situation, you have all three of these parameters non-zero. OK, so to conclude, I think that this TTO stuff is very interesting and important for CFTs generally because of the importance of T. And whether you're in holographic theory or not, there's probably more to say. So let me just stop here. Thanks.